Namaste. So, we continue in Chapter 4, the sacrifice, the triune path, and the Lord of the sacrifice. All instantiation of how it is that we live dynamically in communion with the divine, here and now, Ihaiva. The divine, the eternal, is the Lord of our sacrifice of works, and union with him in all our being and consciousness, and in its expressive instruments, is the one object of the sacrifice. The steps of the sacrifice of works must therefore be measured, first, by the growth in our nature of something that brings us nearer to divine nature, but secondly, also by an experience of the divine, his presence, his manifestation to us, an increasing closeness and union with that presence. But the divine is in his essence infinite. And his manifestation, too, is multitudinously infinite. If that is so, it is not likely that our true integral perfection in being and in nature can come by one kind of realization alone. It must combine many different strands of divine experience. It cannot be reached by the exclusive pursuit of a single line of identity till that is raised to its absolute. It must harmonize many aspects of the infinite. An integral consciousness with a multiform dynamic experience is essential for the complete transformation of our nature. When Jurya Aurobindo wrote this, it might have seemed dramatically different from what recent teachings of yoga conferred upon those interested in the practice. Following a particular line to the realization of the self, a particular line to a consummate communion with the divine beloved, etc., etc., each line had its own direction. Sri Aurobindo and Sri Ramakrishna, in their own sadhana, realized many different lines of spiritual development, achieved many different states of consciousness, and found that one did not compete with the other, that they were, in fact, synthetically part of a whole, and that to lean on one side and leave out the other was an error which left realization incomplete. So, in great recognition of how deep his own development was, we call from time to time our attention to how much of this that he writes is founded not on theory, but on his own practical experience. Sri Ramakrishna might have been a luminous example just a few decades before Sri Aurobindo came back to India and launched upon his own integral yoga. But you find the roots of this back in the Upanishads. You find it in the Bhagavad Gita. You find it in the Tantra as well. Teachings which moved towards a grand union which had been lost over the centuries. So now we have the chance, following Sri Aurobindo's lead, to pull all of this back together and leave none of it out, to combine it in a harmony and fulfill the divine's intention through the life of our own souls embodied upon earth, and make the earth better. Why, denude it of its glory, let's add to its glory. So this for instance, would be consonant with what we see in the Gita in the 7th chapter, the 2nd verse. He says, I'll teach you in full. This knowledge combined with realization, savijnanam, which, being known, nothing further remains to be known. So an essential knowledge which moves beyond the mere instruction to the actual experience and by connotation brings into itself all the principles of being, not simply the essence, but as the essence extends itself into manifestation, those principles too must be known and mastered. This closing sentence, an integral consciousness with a multiform dynamic experience, is essential for the complete transformation of our nature. This recalls to us the close of the Gita, or close to the close, in the 18th chapter, the 57th verse, which we've touched upon before, resonates with this. There is one fundamental perception indispensable towards any integral knowledge or many-sided experience of this infinite. It is to realize the divine in its essential self and truth, unaltered by forms and phenomena. Otherwise, we are likely to remain caught in the net of appearances, or wander confusedly in a chaotic multitude of cosmic or particular aspects. And if we avoid this confusion, it will be at the price of getting chained to some mental formula or shut up in a limited personal experience. The one secure and all-reconciling truth, which is the very foundation of the universe, is this, that life is the manifestation of an uncreated self and spirit. And the key to life's hidden secret is the true relation of this spirit with its own created existences. And so get to the spiritual consciousness. One must get to the purity of the essence of the Atman. The nature, the foundation of world and self is Brahman, which we must penetrate behind all phenomena, behind all the variegation of principles, behind all the gods and the goddesses and every aspect of being that's in front of us, beautiful and foul. We have to get to the essence that underlies it all. There is, behind all this life, the look of an eternal being upon its multitudinous becomings. There is around and everywhere in it the envelopment and penetration of a manifestation in time by an unmanifested, timeless, eternal. But this knowledge is valueless for yoga if it is only an intellectual and metaphysical notion void of life and barren of consequence. A mental realization alone cannot be sufficient for the seeker. So we talked about Sri Ramakrishna. We could also speak about Sri Ramana Maharshi, who had the essence of that experience when they were young, and it stayed with them throughout the rest of their spiritual lives. None of it founded on intellectuality. None of it founded on philosophy. For what yoga searches after is not truth of thought alone or truth of mind alone, but the dynamic truth of a living and revealing spiritual experience. there must awaken us a constant indwelling and enveloping nearness, a vivid perception, a close feeling and communion, a concrete sense and contact of a true and infinite presence always and everywhere. Who cares if you can theorize about the divine? Who cares if you can meditate for hours in uninterrupted silence? If you can commune with the divine presence, if you can enter into that being directly without any of these modalities, thought or meditation structures and the rest of it, if you can simply allow that to suffuse your being with its being, if you will rise to meet it in its heights, if you will live together with it, then you will have the answer you need. There must awaken us a constant indwelling and enveloping nearness, you see, a vivid perception, a close feeling and communion, a concrete sense and contact of a true and infinite presence always and everywhere. So we can't find the divine simply isolated in a unique experience, closed off from everything else. We should be able to open our eyes and see that same divinity in all around us and each being that we contemplate, that we regard, that we meet, because it is an omnipresent reality. Oh. That presence must remain with us as the living, pervading reality in which we and all things exist and move and act. And we must feel it always and everywhere, concrete, visible, inhabiting all things. It must be patent to us as their true self, tangible as their imperishable essence, met by us closely as their inmost spirit. To see, to feel, to sense, to contact in every way, and not merely to conceive this self and spirit here in all existences, and to feel with the same vividness all existences in this self and spirit, is the fundamental experience which must englobe all other knowledge. One being. To live it. This infinite and eternal self of things is an omnipresent reality. And let's pause, because this again is how Sri Aurobindo described the first part of the life divine, the omnipresent reality. And he uses that phrase frequently, even in the life divine appearing as essays in the Arya, even in the first year. But he never used it in the synthesis of yoga. Here, he deliberately revises and inserts that phrase into this chapter. This infinite and eternal self of things is an omnipresent reality, one existence everywhere. It is a single unifying presence and not different in different creatures. It is a single unifying... Pardon me, I just read that. It can be met, seen, or felt in its completeness in each soul or each form in the universe. For its infinity is spiritual and essential, and not merely a boundlessness in space or an endlessness in time. The infinite can be felt in an infinitesimal atom or in a second of time as convincingly as in the stretch of the eons or the stupendous enormity of the intersolar spaces. So this again is the Isha Upanishad, the opening verse. This is William Blake, romantic poet. The knowledge or experience of it can begin anywhere and express itself through anything, for the divine is in all, and all is the divine. This fundamental experience will yet begin differently for different natures and take long to develop all the truth that it conceals in its thousand aspects. I see, perhaps, or feel in myself or as myself first the eternal presence, and afterwards only can extend the vision or sense of this greater self of mine to all creatures. This is normally the path of how this essence is disclosed to one. One can find it more readily inside and then see it outside. Not always does it work that way, but sometimes it does. Frequently it does. I then see the world in me or as one with me. I perceive the universe as a scene in my being, the play of its processes, as a movement of forms and souls and forces in my cosmic spirit. I meet myself and none else everywhere. Not, be it well noted, with the error of the Asura, the Titan, who lives in his own inordinately magnified shadow, mistakes ego for the self and spirit, and tries to impose his fragmentary personality as the one dominant existence upon all his surroundings. For, having the knowledge, I have already seized this reality that my true self is the non-ego. So always my greater self is felt by me either as an impersonal vastness or an essential person, containing yet beyond all personalities, or as both these together. But in any case, whether impersonal or illimitable personal or both together, it is an ego exceeding infinite. If I have sought it out and found it first in the form of it, I call myself, rather than in others, it is only because there it is easiest for me, owing to the subjectivity of my consciousness, to find it, to know it at once, and to realize it. But if the narrow instrumental ego does not begin to emerge in this self as soon as it is seen, if the smaller external mind-constructed I refuses to disappear into that greater, permanent, uncreated spiritual I, then my realization is either not genuine or radically imperfect. There is, somewhere in me, an egoistic obstacle. Some part of my nature has opposed a self-regarding and self-preserving denial to the all-swallowing truth of the spirit. And this has been noted by Western psychologists as well, that as we begin to approach the infinity of that, as we begin to near that essence, something created, something finite in us rebels, retards, refuses, and creates something to stand as an intermediary between us and that. And then that becomes the holy language, the ideal form, etc., through which we can regard that other because we fear so to meet it. But if there is any difference between our soul and that, then there is trepidation, then there is fear. So summon courage and go forward and meet that directly in experience without intermediary. Unguarded, alone, go into the alone. On the other hand, and to some this is an easier way, I may see the divinity first in the world outside me, not in myself, but in others. I meet it there from the beginning as an indwelling and all-containing infinite that is not bound up with all these forms, creatures, and forces which it bears on its surface. Or else I see and feel it as a pure, solitary self and spirit which contains all these powers and existences, and I lose my sense of ego in the silent omnipresence around me. Afterwards, it is this that begins to pervade and possess my instrumental being, and out of it seem to proceed all my impulsions to action, all my light of thought and speech, all the formations of my consciousness and all its relations and impacts with other soul forms of this one worldwide existence. I am already no longer this little personal self, but that, with something of itself put forward, which sustains a selected form of its workings in the universe. So the previous paragraph spoke about us beginning from the individual basis, moving into the essence and including the all. This begins with the cosmic basis, then discovering the truth of our own being, but always with the all around. There is another basic realization, the most extreme of all, that yet comes sometimes as the first decisive opening or an early turn of the yoga. It is the awakening to an ineffable, high, transcendent, unknowable, above myself and above this world in which I seem to move, a timeless and spaceless condition or entity which is at once in some way compelling and convincing to an essential consciousness in me, the one thing that is to it overwhelmingly real. This experience is usually accompanied by an equally compelling sense, either of the dreamlike or shadowy illusoriness of things, of all things here, or else of their temporary, derivative, and only half-real character. For a time at least, all around me may seem to be a moving of cinematographic shadow forms or surface figures, and my own action may appear as a fluid formulation from some source ungrasped as yet, and perhaps unseizable above or outside me. To remain in this consciousness, to carry out this initiation, or follow out this first suggestion of the character of things, would be to proceed towards the goal of dissolution of self and world in the unknowable, moksha, nirvana. But this is not the only line of issue. It is possible, on the contrary, for me to wait till through the silence of this timeless, unfilled liberation, I begin to enter into relations with that yet ungrasped source of myself and my actions. Then the void begins to fill. There emerges out of it, or there rushes into it, all the manifold truth of the divine, all the aspects and manifestations, and many levels of a dynamic infinite. At first, this experience imposes on the mind, and then on all our being, an absolute, a fathomless, almost an abysmal peace and silence, overpowered and subjugated, stilled, liberated from itself. The mind accepts the silence itself as the supreme. But afterwards, the seeker discovers that all is there for him contained or new made in that silence, or through it descends upon him from a greater concealed transcendent existence. For this transcendent, this absolute, is not a mere piece of signless emptiness. It has its own infinite contents and riches, of which ours are debased and diminished values. If there were not that source of things, there could be no universe. All powers, all works and activities would be an illusion. All creation and manifestation would be impossible. So, of course, this paragraph is about him. It is about his realization, consequent upon going to be with Lele and Broda at the tail end of 1907 and in the earliest days of 1908, sitting with him on that roof and having the infinite swallowing, in which he was able to stop the movement of his mind and refuse thought and live still in that absolute silent reality, which seemed to leave the world vacant of all being. And as he says, one can stay there, one could stay there, but he did not. He was compelled to come back into action and resumed his political work in the storm of that fulmination against the British Empire. He picked up the thread and went back into action to dislodge the British and worked on it in this vast silent consciousness. Being in that liberated state did not prevent him from acting, nor was that the final answer, because later, when he was jailed at Alipur, he came into deep connection and communion with the divine person, not the absent impersonality of his first realization in Brahmic Nirvana, but his absorption into the divine person, whom he saw everywhere, in all beings, in all things living, and all things not living. He found that same face of the divine and traced it upwards in subsequent steps of yogic development to discover that there is not simply this creation here, mind, life, and matter, the world of the triple gunas that the Sankhya philosophy measures out, but a transcendent creation above, not simply an absolute, which is sheer white, homogeneous in being, but a perfect creation in which unity and diversity play, in which they stand together, in which they move together, drawing from that unimaginable one, that which is above. So that is a transcendent creation, of which this here is an apparent extension. But that is also here. That supreme nature can appear here, unveiled behind the limited nature that we know. And that's all the point of our ascent, having discovered our souls, into a supramental consciousness, so that we can bridge those worlds and have the riches of that existence pour into this. So he suggests in this paragraph that possibility. So individual, cosmic, transcendent, the three terms of being again. These are the three fundamental realizations, so fundamental that to the yogin of the way of knowledge, they seem ultimate, sufficient in themselves, destined to overtop and replace all others. And yet, for the integral seeker, whether accorded to him at an early stage suddenly and easily by a miraculous grace, or achieved with difficulty after a long progress and endeavor, they are neither the sole truth nor the full and only clues to the integral truth of the eternal, but rather the unfilled beginning, the vast foundation of a greater divine knowledge. Other realizations there are that are imperatively needed and must be explored to the full limit of their possibilities. And if some of them appear to a first sight to cover only divine aspects that are instrumental to the activity of existence but not inherent in its essence, yet, when followed to their end through that activity to its everlasting source, it is found that they lead to a disclosure of the divine without which our knowledge of the truth behind things would be left bare and incomplete. These seeming instrumentals are the key to a secret without which the fundamentals themselves would not unveil all their mystery. All the revelatory aspects of the divine must be caught in the wide net of the integral yoga. The instrumental is that instrumental consciousness which transmits the reality of Satchit-Ananda multitudinously into the manifestation here. And all of the cords of being that flow from that supramental manifestation are necessary as instrumentalities also. So we can go back to, again, the closing verses of the 18th chapter in the Gita to find that. By devotion, he knows me in truth, what and who I am. Then, having known me in truth, he straightway enters into that. That's the 55th verse. We've talked about the 57th before, and I'll leave it at that. You have a copy of the Gita, surely. So we'll set this there for the moment, and we'll read a passage from Savitri. And so far, in these passages, we haven't repeated any section, but some of them are so sublime and perfectly tuned to several different themes that come in synthesis. I hope you don't mind if we do occasionally go back and pick up one that you've heard before. Well, this is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga. This is Canto 5, The Finding of the Soul. Onward she passed, seeking the soul's mystic cave. At first she stepped into a night of God. The light was quenched that helps the laboring world, the power that struggles and stumbles in our life. This inefficient mind gave up its thoughts, the striving heart its unavailing hopes. All knowledge failed, and the ideas forms, and wisdom screened in awe her lowly head, feeling a truth too great for thought or speech, formless, ineffable, forever the same. An innocent and holy ignorance, adored like one who worships formless God, the unseen light she could not claim nor own. In a simple purity of emptiness, her mind knelt down before the unknowable. All was abolished save her naked self and the prostrate yearning of her surrendered heart. There was no strength in her, no pride of force. The lofty burning of desire had sunk ashamed, a vanity of separate self. The hope of spiritual greatness fled. Salvation she asked not, nor a heavenly crown. Humility seemed now too proud a state. Herself was nothing, God alone was all. Yet God she knew not, but only knew he was. A sacred darkness brooded now within. The world was a deep darkness, great and nude. This void held more than all the teeming worlds. This blank felt more than all that time has borne. This dark knew dumbly, immensely, the unknown. But all was formless, voiceless, infinite. As might a shadow walk in a shadowy scene, a small naught passing through a mightier naught, a night of person in a bare outline crossing a fathomless impersonal night, silent she moved, empty and absolute. In endless time her soul reached a wide end. The spaceless vast became her spirit's place. At last a change approached, the emptiness broke. A wave rippled within, the world had stirred. Once more her inner self became her space. There was felt a blissful nearness to the goal. Heaven leaned low to kiss the sacred hill. The air trembled with passion and delight. A rose of splendor on a tree of dreams, the face of dawn out of mooned twilight grew. Day came, priest of a sacrifice of joy, into the worshipping silence of her world. He carried immortal luster as his robe, trailed heaven like a purple scarf, and wore as his vermilion caste mark a red sun. As if an old remembered dream come true, she recognized in her prophetic mind the imperishable luster of that sky, the tremulous sweetness of that happy air, and covered from mind's view and life's approach the mystic cavern in the sacred hill, and knew the dwelling of her secret soul. As if in some Elysian occult depth, truth's last retreat from thought's profaning touch, as if in a rock temple's solitude hid, God's refuge from an ignorant, worshipping world, it lay withdrawn even from life's inner sense, receding from the entangled heart's desire. A marvelous, brooding twilight met the eyes, and a holy stillness held that voiceless space. Namaste, Jai Ma.